in November 1989. It's probably true that no one anticipated the devastating attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in September 2001. And this week, all of us have had a geography lesson. We've found out that 75% of Greenland is covered by a permanent sheet of ice. We've found out that actually this makes only a small part of that island inhabitable. And because of that, it's the world's least densely populated area, with about 56,000 people living across this huge territory. And a third of that 56,000 live in the capital city called Nuuk, and congregating just on part of Greenland. And from that history, or that geography lesson that we've had this week, what we've found out is that these 56,000 people are facing some really uncertain times in the coming months. We've also found out, or reminded ourselves, about the Panama Canal, a waterway that connects the Caribbean Sea with the Pacific Ocean, a shortcut between two bodies of water, saving time and costs for transporting goods. We've been reminded that in 1979, the Jimmy Carter administration gave control of that waterway from the US to Panama, and right the way through of a joint partnership to 1999, where that finished. And what we've seen in the press this week is that a new president or an incoming president suggesting that regional stability and world trade might face uncertain times. When we think about uncertain times, they're mostly bad times. The phrase uncertain times can describe decades of Cold War. It can describe the invasion of Ukraine. It might describe the crash of the housing market. It might describe years of a pandemic or nervous months before an election and a change of governance, a government in a country. When we're happy, when we're content, or when we're confident, when ominous global powers fall, and when the housing market turns around, when vaccines are developed, when officials are sworn in, the phrase uncertain times can temporarily fall out of fashion. The secularists would argue that certain times, by contrast, certain times almost never occur. And yet that's what uncertain times implies. If there is uncertainty, there must also be certainty. And over the next few Sundays here at Trinity, we're going to be looking at some of the writings of Paul, which guide us for living in uncertain times. But in addition to guiding us to living in uncertain times, we're going to see this letter from Paul that points us to the certain return of Jesus and the end of the coming age. And that's my job this morning, is to lead us into the studies or the sermons that will happen over the next few weeks. Because Sunday by Sunday, you'll be looking at 1 Thessalonians, which looks at that living in uncertain times and compares that to the certainty of Jesus' return. 1 Thessalonians, as a side note, is probably the earliest letter that we have from Paul. So as we start to think about the next few Sundays, let's start this morning with a quick synopsis of 1 Thessalonians. We had it read to us today. Hopefully you've still got Acts 17 still open in front of you. We are going to dip into the whole of Acts 17. So we read the first 15 verses. We are going to just refer to a little bit in terms of the rest of the chapter as well. But in this particular part of Paul's letter, we see Paul and his co-worker. We see Paul and his co-worker Silas. We see them leaving the Jewish world and going to the ancient Greek city of Thessalonica. And after just 1 month of telling people the good news of Jesus, a large number of both Jewish and Greek people have given their allegiance to Jesus, and they've formed the first community church there. But in addition to that happening, we also see that trouble was brewing. As Paul's announcement of the risen Jesus led to local opposition. The Christians in Thessalonica were accused of defying Caesar. He was the Roman emperor, and they were saying, in addition to Caesar, there's another king. And we see that in verse 7, where they're pronouncing the king Jesus. And that challenge over Caesar versus Jesus led to the persecution that became so intense that Paul and Silas were forced to flee from Thessalonica. Now, in addition to that happening and that change of plans, that must have hurt them because they loved the people that were there, but they had to move on. And although we only read the first 15 verses of chapter 17, the whole chapter of 17 covers their experience in Thessalonica, Berea, and Athens. You know, those events of those weeks in that particular part must to Paul have felt like the beginning of a Dickens novel. You know the one, it starts, the best of times. It was the best of times. It was also the worst of times. But for Paul, it wasn't a tale of two cities, but a tale of three cities, where some people were responding to the gospel, but others had a very oppositional response. The best of times and the worst of times. And what we see in Acts of the experience that they had results in what we read in 1 Thessalonians that we'll be looking at here in the coming weeks. Because 1 Thessalonians, as Stephen comes next week and others preach on it, is Paul's attempt to reconnect with them after receiving a report. And that report from Timothy was that the Thessalonian Christians were doing more than okay. They were flourishing despite intense persecution. As we unpack 1 Thessalonians over the next few weeks, there are three themes that come through that Sunday by Sunday will be unpacked. The first is holiness in all of our lives. The second is Jesus as the true King of the world. And the third is the certain hope of Jesus' return. And as you look at Thessalonians, perhaps you might read it before next Sunday to get that in your mind. We see a first half of Thessalonians celebrating those people and their faith and their perseverance in those uncertain times. And the second half follows with instructions about good living and details about Jesus' return. So on the basis that what I've said so far this morning, you might say, well, if we're looking at 1 Thessalonians, why did we read a passage from Acts this morning? Well, Acts 17, as you've realised by now, gives us the backstory. It gives us the backstory to 1 Thessalonians, and that's going to be our focus. So let's have a little bit of a look at the background or the backstory of Acts 17. When did Acts 17? The first question is, when did Acts 17 happen? Well, Paul, Silas and Timothy's preaching journey most likely took place between 49 and 52 AD. There are three characters and four sets of people involved. We see Paul, who we know as previously Saul, an apostle who is working in the Mediterranean region, planting churches. We see Silas, originally from Jerusalem, accompanying Paul on his second missionary journey. And we see a disciple from Lystra called Timothy, who joined Paul as he passed through the region preaching. They're the three key characters, but we see a group of philosophers, Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. They were men of Athens that we see in the second half of the chapter who were curious about Paul's message. So we see the three particular cities. We see that the fact, if you look at chapter 16, we see that Paul left Philippi. He travelled through a couple of regions before he spent some time in Thessalonica. He was then run out of Thessalonica and went south to Berea. And then actually we see the chapter concluding with Paul teaching in Athens, Greece. Interesting the things that happened in these stories, because in each of these cities, because there was a similar thing about receptive people, there was a similar thing about opposition, but the people of those particular cities were different in their response. If we look at Thessalonica, we see a riot in verses 1 to 9. As I've said, Paul left Philippi in 16 and he travelled to Thessalonica. For 3 weeks, Paul discussed Jesus' death and his resurrection with the people there. We see in that text that many people were persuaded by Paul's words and became believers. But we also see that some Jews are very jealous and they set the city in uproar. They went to the house of Jason to find Paul and Silas. They were unsuccessful in that, so they dragged out Jason and some other believers and started accusing them of causing trouble. If you look at 10 to 15 of chapter 17, we see they then move on. They move on to Berea. And because of that was because of the disturbance. They went overnight. They travelled south to that next city. And they found a different set of people there. People are very much more open to the gospel message. Look at those words. And interesting if those words could be said about us. They received the word with all eagerness, examining the scriptures daily. But soon the Jews caught up with them. They'd pitched up from Thessalonica, and they learned that, because they'd learned that Paul was in Berea, and they came down to cause trouble. So again, Paul and crowd hot-footed and went to Athens. And that's the bit that we didn't read today. They arrived in Athens. Paul was provoked to teach because he found a city full of idols. He taught in the synagogue, he talked in the marketplace every day. The philosophers brought into the Areopagus and asked him to explain his message because they were unfamiliar with Jesus' life. Paul started teaching them about the true God, the only living God, amid all their stone idols, all their altars to false gods. Paul told them that the God he served had made the heavens, had made the earth, and was too great to be contained in a temple constructed by men. Paul was describing a God as God the Father of all mankind, who gives and sustains life. Very different to the idols that were around the city at the time. And being the offspring of a great father, Paul encouraged the Athenians not to think that the divine being is like gold or like silver or like stone, but of an image formed by art and the imagination of men. God was calling all men to repent because a judgment day was coming. Now that message ended up with him being mocked by some of the people in Athens, but also others were curious and others became to believe. So what we can see in Acts 17 is the environment, is the situation of what was going on as we think about unpacking that letter in the coming weeks of 1 Thessalonians about uncertain times, living in uncertain times with the certain hope that we have in Jesus. Hopefully that background will help us unpack Paul's letter in the coming weeks. But this chapter for 17 and this thinking for today is more than just a piece of historical context pointing to a two-part letter that we're going to look at later. So I'm going to dig into Acts 17 just a little bit in terms of what it might mean and how it might help us today. But hopefully you'll get in your mind this big picture of the background of today and 1 Thessalonians of Paul's big idea. So as you think about today, as you think about the next few weeks, think about the big idea of 1 Thessalonians. And that big idea is that by giving allegiance to Jesus as our King leads to a countercultural and a holy way of life, which can generate suspicion and conflict of those around us. And that big idea that Paul was trying to convey is supplemented by our response and saying that as followers of Jesus, we should respond to such hostility with love, with meeting opposition with grace, with forgiveness and generosity. And that's the big message that Paul was trying to convey. So our job is not today to look at 1 Thessalonians. Our job today is to think about what Acts 17 might be able to tell us over and above a lovely little bit of Mediterranean history of what went on 2,000 years ago. And 1 Thessalonians reminds us that from the very beginning, Jesus had produced a truly countercultural and holy way of life. And that countercultural and holy way of life sometimes generates suspicion and conflict. The response of Jesus' followers to such hostility, as I've said, in terms of that big picture that Paul was trying to convey, our response should be one of love, one of meeting opposition with grace and generosity. The way of life that Jesus calls us to is motivated by the hope of the coming kingdom of Jesus, which began when Jesus was resurrected from the dead. And Acts 17 and the background is pointing to us to a book of Thessalonians that's about holiness, about love and future hope. But Acts 17 does help us a little bit more, because Acts 17 takes all those theories and that idea and that concept of a certain future in Jesus in uncertain times and helps us in Acts 17. It helps us to think about how we might be able to share Jesus in a post-Christian culture. The way that we present the gospel can differ depending on our audience. Have you noticed that in Acts 17, Paul didn't quote a bunch of Old Testament prophecies to the Gentiles in Athens? We see that quite differently in Acts 2, when Peter, with the Jews, is using all those Old Testament stuff. But Paul knew his audience and knew that wouldn't resonate. So when we see Paul talking to the people in Acts 17, particularly in Athens, he doesn't quote that bunch of Old Testament prophecies. What we do see is in verse 28 that Paul even quoted from the Gentiles poets, from their own poets. But he took where they're at and pointed, using their experiences and their poets and their writing, to point to the one true God. And we can learn from Paul here. When teaching others, we should take some time out to try and understand their backgrounds, their culture, and their sources of authority. And as we interact with people, we can ask God to help us use these facts to present the message of Jesus in an impactful way to a particular audience that we're trying to share about Jesus. And that's what 17 is. It's a historic account of Paul taking the message to a Gentile audience. He's taken the message that had previously been articulated to the Jewish world and translating it to the audience, the worldview of the audience he was facing. As Paul and his co-workers met these people in Greece, they were meeting without a shared experience. They were meeting without a shared story. The touch points of the previous Jewish audience around creation, around sin, around the Exodus, around judgment, around heaven, and around hell didn't resonate, didn't apply to Paul's Greek audience. The touch points of that day had gone. And it's the same for us, that as we're sharing Jesus in a post-Christian culture, we've got to do it in a way that's accessible and understandable to folk, without assuming that they understand of things about the cross, about the snake crusher, and all those things that we know as being part of church that they won't know. We've got to find a way of sharing Jesus. If you think about Paul and his co-workers lifting themselves out from that Jewish world into the Gentile world in AD 50, their message to a Greek audience must have felt like it was coming from another planet. And in 2025, how do we communicate the message of Jesus to people in an accessible way where we don't have those historic, spiritual, biblical church common touch points? In today's passage, we see Paul adopting four principles in his approach to his audience. These four principles can be found in a book called Unplugged by Dan Strange, and for me, they were very helpfully summarised recently in my home church. The first of these four principles, if you look at what Paul was doing, is Paul entered the world of those Gentiles. I'm particularly looking at Athens, but you can see that by deferring the other two cities as well. But in Athens, we see Paul taking a tour of the city. We see him looking at local culture. And in verse 16 in Athens, he said he was greatly distressed to see a city full of idols. He saw a deeply religious and superstitious people who were looking for higher powers to control aspects of their lives. In verse 21, we see that locals and foreigners alike, all that live there, they talked and they listened to new ideas and they loved the listening and talking. In verse 23, we see that Paul, before he preached to the inhabitants, he had observed a culture referencing to looking at objects of worship. He'd seen that culture where they were thinking about worship and they were looking at objects to worship. And Paul concluded that for the people he was talking to, and that might be the same for people that we talk to, it wasn't whether or not someone is a worshipper, but it was what they were worshipping. And that could be the same for us today, as Paul found, but for us today, for those outside of true faith, they could be worshipping recognition, worshipping fame, worshipping money, worshipping jobs, worshipping another person. As we think about sharing our faith, as Paul was doing in that region in the Mediterranean, it could be that people we are talking to are actually spiritual people. YouGov did a survey in 2022 and they found that 3 in 10 Britons said that they were spiritual. more so with women, 35%, less so with men at 22%. The difference is less pronounced when it came to religion, when 21% of women and 17% of men said they were religious. But that YouGov survey found that people are religious, or a whole chunk of people are religious. They just haven't unpacked and found the true faith in Jesus. They also, if you think about the idols that we saw there in Athens, and we sort of see in the scriptures, they're also trying to create something to make their world a better place. And you've probably heard about, and hopefully not spent too much time looking at, but the concept of manifesting. The word manifest was looked up 130,000 times in the Cambridge Dictionary in 2024, making it one of the most viewed words of the year. And the word manifest, you know, this standing and claiming that something's going to happen, and by merely claiming it to a mirror in front of you that reality will be different, the word manifest jumped from really only being used in the self-help community to actually social media and a wide range of coverage. In particular, singer Dua Lipa, Gabby Thomas, the Olympic sprinter, and the English footballer Ollie Watkins, all speaking of manifesting, of telling themselves that they can manifest an improvement in their lives. And it gained traction. We saw that through perhaps the COVID pandemic as well, and growing in years, and we'll see that in social media with the hashtag manifest. But what we find is that most people that we interact with on a day-to-day basis, whether work co-workers, whether people at lunch club, whether people in our family, whether our friends, most people are living for something, not existing for nothing. And almost all of our opportunities to share Jesus will consist of meeting without that common shared story or experience. The touch points of the previous generation, like an understanding of creation, of sin, of the Exodus, the cross, judgment, heaven and hell, didn't apply to the Greek audience and probably won't apply to the people that we see in North Essex today. So if we want to share Christ effectively, we need to enter their world and see what they are worshipping, see where they're placing their hope, and responds with a Jesus-centric message. The second thing that we see Paul doing, conveniently it begins with E, you'll see that the it'll be four E's, this second E, is that Paul engages with his audience. You see, particularly in Athens, but also you see in the other two cities, meeting in marketplaces and things like that, Paul met with his audience where they were. He didn't expect them to come to church. Well, I appreciate there weren't churches at that point, but do bear with me, you know what I mean. He met his audience where they were. And when Paul met with those people, he did not start by mocking them and tearing up their worldview. Paul focuses on the common ground. Look at particularly in Athens. He says, people of Athens, I can see that you're religious. I can see that you've got the appetite for the divine. And he didn't go for tearing them up, but he picked up on a positive. He said, I understand your desire to be for the divine. At verse 23, he seized on an open question to the open question of an altar to an unknown God. And she said, you know what? Let me plug that gap for you. In verse 28, as I mentioned earlier on, Paul quotes a couple of their own poets and says some of what they say is true. He affirms what is right in their world, in their worldview, things like justice, helping the marginalised, dignity, equality, freedom. He engaged with his audience, but then he exposed the problem. And that's the third thing that Paul was doing. Because in verse 22, Paul is exposing the problem. He said, I've walked around your city. I can see you're really religious folk. But you know what? I saw an altar to an unknown God. And using that, he was able to suggest to the inhabitants of the city that they were ignorant and caused them to stop and think. What Paul did there with exposing the problem is he exposed the crack in the people of Athens' thinking, and he plugs that crack in verses 24-28. And he plugs that gap with a challenge based on if you really knew your God. Paul was telling his audience that within a city with an idol hedging every bet, and even an idol to an unknown God just in case, he was saying that your religious itch, your spiritual itch, is clearly not being scratched. He was explaining to them that their worldview was not stacking up, and the views they were holding and their gods were built in sand. And having done those three things, we find a final E where Paul clearly shares the good news, evangelizes. So we see finally that Paul shares the good news, he evangelizes. Paul doesn't assume that his audience knew the Bible, and neither should we. The tail end of chapter 17 doesn't provide an account to the people of Athens that's wrapped up in the light of language of the Lion of Judah, of the snake crusher, of the Son of God. Rather, in the final verses of the chapter, Paul clearly evangelizes, proclaiming the good news of Jesus in verse 31. And what was Paul was doing, having met with those people and entered and understand and got to that point, what Paul was saying, he was saying, I'm like a former beggar showing another beggar where to get bread. And by doing that, Paul was pointing to the real deal and convincingly saying to the people of Athens and the other cities, have you heard what this Jesus has done for me? And meeting those folk where they are and speaking to them in an accessible way shook the people of Athens. And our experience today is that message of Jesus and that countercultural way of living in uncertain times still shakes people today. Paul was establishing amongst those Gentiles a new world with the people of these three cities. Is this a world that shapes who we are as Christians today and how we enter or understand other people's worlds? How we engage with our audience? How we expose the problem in their thinking, and how we clearly evangelize, clearly share the good news of Jesus. So as you think about Acts 17 during the course of the week and maybe at home group, yeah, have a nice history lesson, have a bit of geography about the Mediterranean in that time. But think about how Acts 17 can help us. Do those four E's of enter, engage, expose and evangelize give us a structure for engaging people that have a very different worldview to us? Equally, do those four E's help us avoid jumping in with religious fervour and resist the needlessly trashing other people's worldviews? And alternatively, exposing the cracks in people's lives and showing them the reality and the difference that Jesus can make. We see in this story, we see in this chapter, we see in this account, that when Paul did it, some sneered, some wanted a bit of time, some wanted to hear more, and some come to faith. Let us offer a better story by sowing the seeds of the gospel and let the Holy Spirit work.